And put your questions in the chat box. And now everybody can see the chat box. So if there's a conversation going there, you can see all of it. Or if more information, staff a lot of times has more information to add. I did want to alert the students and everyone else that we have one change in our schedule on October 18th. I would like the students to gather personally. So we'll have the class in person at the Laurie Center. So I will be sending the class an email with the room number on that. We've got it's a special deal that I want to show you all and have you participate in a conversation with respect to that. So I will send you an email. For those of you that join our class that aren't signed up, we'll just sign off on that date, October 18th. And Brad Udall, who was scheduled to speak, will speak now that last day in November. So we'll go out with a bang with Brad Udall. I think that's all I have right now. So let me introduce our guest speaker, who's Carmen Farmer. She's a conservation project manager for Colorado Open Lands. That group is a statewide land trust protecting over 500,000 acres in Colorado. She has an interesting job. She works with landowners, farmers, municipalities for land and water conservation opportunities. Carmen is a land use attorney by trade from the East Coast, but she was smart enough to come west and call Colorado her home. I've asked her to talk about ecosystem sustainability, and she's going to talk about that about land, how conservation of land and water benefit the ecosystem. So, Carmen, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Jennifer. I appreciate the introduction. I'm a transplant like many other Coloradans in today's age, but happy to be in Colorado. I'm actually in North Carolina at the moment, so forgive me. I'm on family vacation, and I've been relegated to the children's bunk room as my office. So the wonders of Zoom. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And as Jennifer mentioned, I'm going to talk to you a little bit through the lens of a land trust and kind of what we're trying to do with both land and water conservation in Colorado. I do not have an ecology background. I'm not a scientist. I am an attorney by training. And so I'm going to speak more to how we structure this protection mechanism and get into the nuts and bolts of that, and then talk a little bit about how we apply that to protecting important ecosystems throughout the state. Please feel free to interrupt me at any point. I want this to be very much a dialogue. I'm not a teacher. I want this to feel more like a conversation. So feel free to ask questions at any point and interrupt me or put something in the chat. Let's see if I can share my screen with you all. Can folks see this?
Yeah, we can see it. You just need to put it on presentation mode. There we go. Yeah.
Just get my presenter mode. Great. So again, I'm with Colorado Open Lands, and we're a statewide land trust. We're a nonprofit, 501c3, and we work across the state to protect land and water. So that means land in terms of farmland, ranch land, open space, and then water rights that are associated with that land. And we do that for a number of different reasons. And I'll get into that in a little bit more detail as we go on. But I'm going to focus on working lands, and you'll hear me talk about the agricultural sector in particular. And that's our bread and butter. It's private lands conservation. And there's important reasons for doing that. And we'll talk about that as well. But that's kind of our overall organization. In terms of kind of an agenda for today, let's see. Basically, we'll talk about the role of private lands conservation and ecosystem sustainability, how it supports that. I'm going to get into a conservation easement, which is a legal term and is the primary mechanism for how we achieve conservation on private lands. We'll talk about why landowners would want to do this in terms of the benefits, and then why land and water. Traditionally speaking, land trusts have been around for about 40 years and have done a good job of protecting land, but I want to emphasize again the importance of protecting the water because that'll support a lot of the conservation values on that land. And then in terms of, you know, conserving land, we're going to talk about what happens next. And I'll give you a couple of examples of projects that we've got going on, in particular in the northeast part of the state, with regard to both protection, enhancement, restoration, et cetera. So again, questions are welcome any time. Please feel free to interrupt me. And Jennifer, if you see anything in the comments, please go ahead. And
I will do. Yeah.
Thanks. So again, I mentioned working lands. As many of you know, ecosystems don't necessarily recognize geographic boundaries created by governing bodies. We see this with the case in Estes Park. If any of you have ever been up there, you'll see plenty of elk roaming around town. They don't care if they're in Rocky Mountain National Park or down in the private lands. And so one of the ways that we support entire ecosystems is integrating the protection and enhancement of working lands. Some of you may know this, but you know, in terms of overall acreage in Colorado, this is a map that demonstrates in green the public and tribal lands of the state. But then in white, you know, this is the private lands that we have outside of those public lands. In total, the public land makes up about 43% of the state, whereas, you know, a majority, 56, 57% is private. So that's a lot of private land that's either unprotected, developed, or somewhere in between. In terms of existing easement or existing conservation that's happened on private lands, this map gives you a little bit of flavor of that. In terms of the pink that you'll see on there, those are lands, private lands that are protected via conservation easements. And then the yellow are also conservation easements. Those are actually conservation easements that we hold at Colorado Open Lands. In total, about 4.5% of the private land in Colorado has been protected. That's not a huge number when you think about the total acreage in Colorado, which is somewhere north of 66 million acres. So our focus really is on trying to protect private land that supports public land. And in terms of doing that, you know, we recognize various different conservation values. Some of which are wildlife habitat ecosystems. Some of them are, you know, scenic views. Others could be recreational opportunities. There's various reasons to conserve open space. In terms of our planning, it depends on, you know, kind of the particular property, what sort of ecosystem it supports, whether it's part of a larger ecosystem complex, or if it's particularly under threat. And so those are kind of some of the things that go into our planning in terms of conserving and managing overall ecosystems. And we use a combination of resources to prioritize that effort. Some of you may have heard of the Colorado Natural Heritage Program. They specialize in surveying, cataloging, the distribution and condition of Colorado's native ecosystems. And so they've done some sophisticated mapping through a GIS that help us identify areas that are of, you know, ecological significance. We also overlay this with, you know, potential growth management boundaries for municipalities, counties, other governing bodies, in looking at threats. And so we've got the GIS ability to really prioritize and strategically go after certain properties to try to conserve them for various ecological reasons. In my neck of the woods, I work primarily in northeastern Colorado, so pretty much Larimer County out east. The ecosystems that we're focused on tend to be, you know, shortgrass prairie, foothills, and montane. But in other places, we've got, you know, out in Gunnison, for instance, sagebrush, shrubland, and other things like that. And it all depends upon that particular area that we're working in. what we're trying to accomplish and what's already been accomplished. I'll show you a map of the Laramie Foothills here shortly that's going to show you the amount of conservation that's already gone on in that area, in particular with the help of groups like the Nature Conservancy, Larimer County Open Lands, and other organizations like Colorado Parks and Wildlife. So in terms of a land trust and how we go about protecting that land, the tool that I mentioned earlier is a conservation easement. And for folks that aren't familiar with conservation easements, it's a voluntary legal agreement that restricts certain types of development on a property and certain uses of a property. And it's recorded in the land records. We draft what's called a deed of conservation easement. And it gets recorded in the land records and runs with the land, as we say in legal terms. In other words, it encumbers that property when that property is transferred to the next generation or sold off to someone. That easement goes with the property in perpetuity. There are a few exceptions, one of which could be accommodation for road expansion. Let's say I-25 is expanding or power line has to go through a particular property. In those instances, those could potentially extinguish an easement, but otherwise an easement is in perpetuity. And it's important to note that it's placed on both the land and the water rights. So, traditionally on the Front Range, we've seen a lot of what we call buy and dry, where farms are bought, dried up, and the water rights are severed from a property so that municipalities can convert those for new taps as they grow. When we do a conservation easement, we prohibit the separation of the water rights from the land. We want to make sure that that water stays on that property because that water, for a number of reasons. One, if it's an agricultural property, it supports the viability of that property in terms of growing food or fiber. Alternatively, it also has ecological influence on the system hydrologically. When we're talking about return flows, incidental wetlands, and then just overall habitat. I'll get into a couple more examples of that and how that looks on the ground out on the South Platte. But from our perspective, we think that the water significantly impacts the conservation value of a particular property. And so we insist that the water rights are encumbered with the conservation easement. Any questions on that at this point? So conservation easements are created by statute. They were originally created about 40 years ago. And part of the reason for creating the conservation easement in terms of incentivizing folks was tax deductions, so federal tax deductions. And so these are creatures of the IRS code. And so qualified conservation contribution, which would be for doing a conservation easement, essentially if I agree to protect my land through a conservation easement, I am entitled to certain tax benefits, both at a federal level and at a state level. In order for them to qualify, it's got to be a qualified real property interest, so a piece of land that I own and have title to a qualified organization. In our case, we're a land trust. We're accredited by the Land Trust Alliance, but there's a whole host of other organizations. It could be, the Nature Conservancy or the Trust for Public Land. It could be Boulder County Open Space or Larimer County Open Lands. So any of those organizations would be qualified, and it has to be exclusively for conservation purposes. You may have heard about some conservation easement abuses back east on golf courses. That's not a qualified conservation purpose. And so it's important that when you structure these, you think about the conservation value, and we have to actually outline and get what's called a baseline done by a biologist who goes out there and takes a look at the property and can attest to the conservation value of that property. And then finally, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's got to be in perpetuity. Perpetuity is a long time. And so when we're drafting these deeds of conservation easement, we're trying to think about what that property is going to look like in 100, 200 years. What is agriculture going to look like in a couple of hundred years? And it's a little bit of a daunting task when you think about limiting the use of a property. And so we try to be forward thinking in terms of not handcuffing future generations too much by it. But we also want to make sure that conservation easement is going to prohibit, development that would negatively impact conservation values.
And so, Carmen, there's a question in the chat, but before that, I want to ask you, It says exclusively for conservation purposes. So that means keeping the land as is. Is it now? Or are we looking also to restore the land somewhat in those easements?
That's a great question. And conservation purposes is actually defined by the IRS. I'll get to that in this slide. It's as is. However, some of the conservation easements we do, if they have funders involved, let's say Great Outdoors Colorado or Colorado Parks and Wildlife, or another entity like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is funding some of the conservation easement cost. Sometimes they'll have stipulations in there for improvements to the condition of that land. And that could be enhancement. That could be restoration of historic wetlands, back channels. It could be, and we'll talk about an example here in a minute, specific restoration elements for specific species.
Okay. The question in the chat talks about root shoot balting in lowland. It has a 100-year lease. Mm-hmm. Is that a step into a conservation easement?
Yeah, great question. We're actually working with Olander Farm, Olander family, who are the owners of Root Shoot Malting on a conservation easement. And we're doing some fundraising for that particular project. So that's kind of them dipping their toes into the conservation world. We can put a link in the chat for that. It's a short film that was produced about a year ago. It details actually, a not uncommon story with our young farmers on the Front Range and the inability to either stay on farmland or acquire new farmland. With water values going up astronomically, trying to purchase a farm with good water rights for a young person is really hard these days. And so it's an interesting conundrum in terms of access to farmland. We've got this great new generation of farmers that are coming up who are interested in regenerative ag practices and thinking about soil health and thinking about different and innovative ways of producing food or other things on their land. And so the challenge we're going to see in Northern Colorado is the affordability of farmland. When we're growing, I think Weld County between the last census grew by 30%. When you're growing that fast, it's hard for farmers to compete with subdivision development prices in terms of buying land and water. And so I'll send out a link to that 100-year.
Actually, somebody put a link in. Oh,
perfect. Wonderful.
So we've got it. Thanks. Yeah.
Wait till after the lecture to watch it. No, please do. If this is boring, go for it. So great question. And that's a specific instance where that landowner is, or that family, I should say, is pursuing a conservation easement as we speak.
Dixie, I think, put that in there. Thanks, Dixie.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. They're great, the Olanders. Go check them out. And so just to get back to kind of the nuts and bolts of the legal side of conservation, at least conservation easements. Again, there's got to be conservation purposes to qualify. Generally speaking, it's either public recreation, so trails, or it could be fishing access, hunting access, et cetera. And let me just note, it doesn't have to be all of these. You just have to have to document the conservation values or purposes that are specific to that particular land. The one we use most often is protection of relatively natural habitat. And that can apply to farmland, that can apply to ranch land. Again, I'm going to emphasize that we are helping to conserve working lands. That's the majority of the land in Colorado in terms of, the 56% private land ownership. And so that farmland, even if it's row crops today, it has the potential to be, relatively natural habitat or habitat for a species during a particular time of year. Let's say it's winter range or it's on the outskirts of town and that's all they've got to get around town. And so Preservation of relatively natural habitat is probably the most common conservation purpose we'll include in our easement. Preservation of open space. So this can be for scenic vistas, or if there's a clearly delineated conservation policy. And by policy, that could be, you know, Larimer County identifying this particular area is important for conservation. It could be CNHP or the Colorado Natural Heritage Program identifying it. If we've got that, we can include that to help qualify for conservation purposes. And then a separate subset is historically important land area. We don't get into that as much, but that is one of the options out there.
So another question, this is from Martha Young. How does regenerative farming work with the as-is aspect of conservation easements?
So we try to put our landowners, we have about 550 conservation easements throughout the state. And one of the things we offer is to try to connect them. We've got a landowner liaison whose job is to talk to them about opportunities to, you know, improve the quality of their land, you know, think about, you know, managing for specific species, or if they want to upgrade irrigation infrastructure or start thinking about regenerative ag practices, you know, whether that's putting in cover crops, you know, using animals on the land, various different components. And we'll oftentimes connect them to folks that can help them with those resources. Whether it's that's like the Savory Institute or their local NRCS office. And so it's not something that's required in most of the conservation easements, but it's something that we're certainly trying to get information out to the landowners to think about. And that even goes as far as starting to think about carbon sequestration markets and opportunities there for folks that are conserving their land to think through what options are out there as we start to see some of those markets get off the ground.
Thanks. Yeah, good. Go ahead.
And I'm almost done with the legal part of this, and we'll start getting into some examples. Let's see here. Again, why would landowners do this? There's some significant tax benefits associated with both the IRS or the Internal Revenue Code, and then also the state. You know, there's a federal income tax deduction, and I can get into the weeds on this with folks offline, but the big thing that drives people in Colorado is that we have a state income tax credit up to 90% of the easement value. So let's say you have a $2 million property, you want to put an easement on it, and that's going to reduce the value of your property by $1 million. That difference, or that delta, that $1 million is the value of your conservation easement. And so per state code, you can qualify for a tax credit up to 90% of that $1 million, or $900,000. And the thing that Colorado and three other states have done is made that tax credit transferable. And so that's a huge incentive for people. By transferable, I mean that you can monetize it. So if a landowner qualifies for that $900,000 tax credit, they can actually sell it. Most folks don't have that much state tax income liability, especially if you're a farmer and you're writing things off. So in terms of, you know, a carrot, that's a big one for a lot of our landowners, and a way for them to get paid to do the conservation easement, essentially. There's some other smaller tax ramifications that I won't get into, like estate tax reduction and local assessment treatment. But those are the gist of landowner benefits in terms of dollars if you're donating a conservation easement. The other way that we are able to incentivize folks to do conservation easements is through grant writing that we are able to provide to them. And these are, you know, funds that are out there from organizations like the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Great Outdoors Colorado, some of you may have heard of, which is funded through the Colorado Lottery, and a whole host of other different organizations, including some private foundations like the Walton Family Foundation. In those cases, those organizations have grant programs that will actually pay people for conservation easements. And generally speaking, I'd say that that's probably 80% of our portfolio of easements nowadays. There's some combination of a funded grant And then some combination of tax benefits. Again, our goal, you know, these landowners are giving up some value in terms of protecting their land. And so we're trying to find ways to get them kind of the best bang for their buck in terms of doing that, particularly where we're dealing with a property where there's some significant conservation value in terms of the identified conservation purposes that we talked about before. So that's just kind of the quick and dirty on how a conservation easement works. And that's kind of our tool that we use. But that's just the beginning in terms of the how. It doesn't necessarily always get to the why. And so, you know, let's say you've got a property conserved, what next? And that got to the question. I appreciate the question about regenerative ag earlier. After we conserve a property, we don't just sort of say, okay, great, it's done. Let's put it on a map. And say it's protected, because we, one as a land trust, have an obligation to monitor that property on an annual basis, to go out and see it and take photos and document it. And then if we go out there and there's some enforcement issue in terms of the conservation easement, we're required to make sure that it's remedied in terms of any sort of violation, and worst case scenario, go to court and actually defend the conservation easement. And so we take that very seriously. But we also want to be a resource for our landowners in terms of thinking about ways that they can enhance that property. And maybe it's for, you know, the management of a specific species. Maybe it's a soil health practice. Maybe it's, you know, opportunities to share some of that water. So while our easements protect the water in terms of severing it from the property, they also allow for some limited sharing. And that could be with a local municipality, that could be for an in-stream flow opportunity, or that could be a combination of those. We're working with a municipality right now, a couple of landowners, and potentially the Colorado Water Trust, which helps with in-stream flows, to think through ways to share some of that water for a particular stretch of river that could use it. And then also potentially pull that water back out after that stretch of river to satisfy some growing needs for a municipality downstream. And this is kind of viewed as a way to share the water, to both save the farm and to provide a little extra water to the municipality that's growing, so they don't have to go out, buy farmland and dry it up. We're hoping to pilot some more opportunities like this. And it's also a way for farmers to potentially diversify their income stream. Let's say in a particular year, you know, they deficit irrigate. So instead of 3 acre feet per acre, maybe it's 2 acre feet per acre, they only get 2 cuttings of hay instead of 3. And so they're still putting that water on the farm, still protecting the conservation value, but also potentially getting a payment from a municipality downstream to keep that water in the river during a particular time where it's really dry. And so those are just a couple of examples, general examples, about how we're trying to think about using that conserved land or using the opportunity with that relationship for a landowner to think about ways that we can manage those resources, both within the framework of the property and then in a larger sort of regional context. We doing okay on time, Jennifer?
Yeah, we're okay. It's 4:30, so.
And so I wanted to give you all just a couple of examples of some projects that we're working on or have worked on here recently. The first is has to do with this little guy, and this is a Preble's Meadow jumping mouse. I've never actually seen one in real life. they're nocturnal, but this subspecies is actually listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And so one of the interesting projects that I got to work on recently was to protect some land regarding this particular species. And this is a map of the Laramie foothills, if you will. And this is just northwest of Fort Collins for folks that are familiar with Livermore. Livermore is kind of right in the middle of the map here. And this map gives you a sense of the conserved private lands in this area. If you look at the legend, you'll see that there's quite a bit of conservation that's gone up on up here. And a lot of this can be attributed to, you know, the Nature Conservancy and the work that Heather Knight did, you know, over the course of the last 25 years in conjunction with Legacy Land Trust and Larimer County Open Space and a whole host of other partners that came together to protect a lot of the private lands up there. If you've ever driven up 287 to Laramie, you'll see there's not a whole lot of houses up there. And a lot of that's because of that great work that they've done. This also happens to be this North Fork of the Poudre River area where, you know, the Preble's Meadow jumping mouse habitat is highly concentrated in terms of where it was historically, and then also opportunities where we've got enough intact riparian areas to support that population. And so we worked on a it's actually a mitigation bank. This is in response to a proposed reservoir that's going to go in north of that area. And so anytime you impact a habitat for a particular threatened or endangered species, you have to offset it and mitigate. In this case, the mitigation is going to happen on this easement area here, which is owned by the State Land Board. You can see this is a basically a section here, right off of 287 here, just outside of Livermore. This red area is the conservation easement area. And this is working land, even though it's State Land Board land, which is owned by the state. For folks that don't know, the State Land Board owns, I think, somewhere around 3 million acres of land throughout Colorado. And they are tasked with leasing that land out to generate income for K-12 schools. So essentially, this property's been leased to graze for, gosh, better part of the last 100 and some years. And so it's been fairly degraded. Stonewall Creek runs through the middle of the property here. And it's pretty much been freely grazed over the course of that time. But this is prime Preble's Meadow jumping mouse habitat. And so we worked with the State Land Board to both protect it, but as a condition of doing the mitigation bank, they also had to do some restoration work and then also control the grazing in this area. So the riparian corridor has essentially been fenced out to limit grazing to certain instances to help that both understory and overstory redevelop. And I think we've got about 2 miles of creek throughout this area. But this is an example of both the protection of this area, which could have been developed. It's not far from Fort Collins and could have been chopped up into 35 acre subdivided homes pretty easily. So there's the protection element, but then there's also the enhancement and restoration element. And it's going to be interesting. The fencing went in earlier this year, and we're going to go out at various points throughout the year to take photos and monitor it. There'll be some trapping that goes on over the course of the next few years. And we're working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in this particular case on land that has traditionally been working land to try to think through ways that we can support this particular ecosystem and this particular subspecies that relies upon this ecosystem. I think, is there a question in the chat?
There is, but it talks about the soil health practices. So I didn't want to hop in here. I thought I'd let you get through this example and then come back to it.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Let me, I can transition to that in just a second. So again, this is an example of a specific ecosystem. You know, this easement, because it was funded, it was not a tax credit easement, had some strings attached to it from the funding, where they had to implement a management plan, a long-term management plan that would address grazing. The property, this doesn't mean that a property can't be grazed, it just limits the access to that riparian area as we redevelop it and restore it to support, well, actually, I mean, not just that species, but other subspecies as well in terms of aquatic species, particularly as you start to get that riparian vegetation back in there. Is this Anne's question? Let's see.
Anne's question, yeah, about soil health practices. What does that entail in relation to agricultural land? And are there incentives for farmers using less harmful herbicides, pesticides, or more sustainable water practices?
I can't speak to incentives that we have the ability. We as a land trust, we can't go into the level of detail to specify what herbicides, pesticides, et cetera, can be used on the property. We do have to make sure that that water is being put to beneficial use and that it doesn't end up on any abandonment list. We do like to connect folks though to resources like NRCS, or I mentioned the Savory Institute, to learn about opportunities there where it may be, a more sustainable water practice, converting from flood irrigation to drip irrigation, for instance, or converting to no-till or limited till. Obviously, things like cover crops and access to that and the science around that. I don't know if that answers your question, Anne, but we're trying to connect more and more of our farmers to those resources. But as far as incentives, I can't speak specifically to those.
Well, no, I think from your perspective, that was good. I would just remind the class that we will have the Commissioner of Agriculture for Colorado at one of our classes next month or maybe in November. So that would be a great question to say for her.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, I'm actually going to try to attend that one because I'll probably have some questions. Great question though. The whole regenerative ag space right now is really interesting. And it, particularly when you're talking to farmers who are very input and output based, when you can show them the improvements to soil health in terms of organic matter, and then also water holding capacity and a whole host of other, potential yield increases. It's really fascinating because that really gets them thinking, at least in my experience in talking to some of our producers on the ground, thinking about those practices and ways that they can implement their practices or implement some of those practices in their own operations.
I had a quick question about the current slide.
Sure.
Go ahead, CJ.
Did you say that you already had fencing up to keep livestock out of the riparian area?
Yes, the fencing went in earlier this year.
And is that riparian area what appears to snake right through the potential easement area?
Correct.
So if it's a potential easement area, how is it that you've already got conservation practices going up if the easement hasn't been completed?
Yeah, sorry about that. Well, so this easement has been completed. And as a condition of them qualifying to complete the easement, we had to have the fencing in that particular case in place prior to the easement. And both the fencing is in place and the easement has been completed.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And one more follow-up question. Are there other conservation efforts going on other than fencing, just fencing out of the riparian area? Is there any rotational grazing or something like that going on?
Yeah, so they had as part of a long-term management plan, well, there's a short-term management plan and a long-term management plan that addressed the grazing and has certain flash grazing for weed control provisions in there. But as we start to reestablish, and there's some vegetation planting going on in that area too. This stream doesn't always have water in it. And so that's part of what's going on in terms of the planting there. But yeah, there is a grazing plan in place, and that grazing plan will be updated over time. And we have to check in every few years to make sure that the plan is being adhered to, and then also to think about any changes that we might have to make to that plan, particularly with regard to stocking numbers as we get drier and hotter. It's something that's going to be, the easement, I almost hate to make this sort of parallel, but the easement is sort of, it's the constitution. It's not going to change. But the grazing plan, the long-term management plan, is something that we'll check in with, routinely to see how that may need to be adjusted. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. Thank you.
Yeah. Great question. Well, I'm going to just shift gears really quick to one other project that we're working on in terms of thinking about on the ground what an easement looks like, and then, you know, a particular management looks like with regard to a property. And these are, you know, these are some of our waterfowl habitat easements, for lack of a better word. But essentially, these are situations where we've got, you know, farmers who have water rights and want to manage for, you know, particular species or waterfowl. In this case, it's ducks during the flyover seasons in the fall and the spring. And we work with Ducks Unlimited, actually, to help think through what the protection would look like and then what the restoration. In this specific example of augmentation ponds that provide, you know, important seasonal wetland complexes during those shoulder seasons of irrigation. And so essentially what happens here is we protect a farm, we protect the water right, and they've got this water right that they can actually flood these shallow water wetlands in the late fall and early spring when those waterfowl really can use those complexes. And in some cases, it's a junior water right, and that's the only time they can really use that water right. But it's an opportunity for them to manage these properties for this particular ecosystem in habitat profile with regard to this species. And some of this funding that is provided for these particular easements comes from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through their North American Wetlands Conservation Act, which is tasked with trying to create a certain level of this throughout, really, the flyover area, which, you know, goes way beyond Colorado. But out in eastern Colorado along the South Platte, you'll see some of these playas and complexes. And this gets into a little bit of the weeds with regard to Colorado water law, but essentially these return flows and accretions allow landowners to pump out of the aquifer. And so in this pretty simplified example, these recharge ponds create augmentation credits that you can pump against, or the farmer can pump against. But essentially, we're not only giving that farmer the ability to pump against those return flows, we're also giving them the ability to create habitat for those particular species. And so what they'll do is they'll fill these recharge ponds in the shoulder seasons. You know, those recharge ponds allow the water to infiltrate back into the aquifer. It's kind of a debit, like, you know, you think about your bank account. So then they can draw water out of the aquifer based upon that. This has been an attractive thing for some of our landowners out east who are looking at ways to provide duck habitat, to enhance duck habitat, and then also to accrue pumping rights, if you will, for irrigation purposes. And so this is another example of where we're working with protected properties to try to create, you know, that particular habitat. And then one more example that's similar, but a little bit different, is in terms of, this is in South Park or Park County, headwaters of the South Platte River. Basically what we have here, South Park was dried up. Many folks may know this, but, you know, Front Range municipalities, long, long time ago, beavers were killed off. Cattle were introduced, grazing practices essentially disconnected the floodplains from these eroded stream beds. So, you know, those ecosystems lost a lot of their function. And so what we've done is, through some funding that's conditional upon conservation easements and then a restoration element, been able to go in and essentially, what we're calling it, is reconnect that riparian corridor to the floodplain. We do this a number of ways. Some of it's grading. Some of it involves BDAs or beaver dam analogs. But essentially, it slows down the water table, allows for less erosion, allows for beavers to come back in. They're obviously wonderful ecosystem builders. And then part of it is planning, but part of it is also having a grazing plan in place so that these corridors can start to regenerate and rebuild themselves. Excuse me. And so this is another example where the property was conserved in that top photograph here in this condition. Because of the conservation, we're able to go in, assist the landowner with other consultants to put in these measures and improve the functionality of that particular ecosystem. And we've done about 550 acres of this, or 15 stream miles in Park County. And we got a lot of interest from the landowners up there in doing this. And so.
Those are great pictures. That's a great way to look at what it's doing.
Sorry, guys, I'm bumping up against my time. So I'm going to wrap this up pretty quickly and then open the floor, because I know this, we're kind of really giving you a broad spectrum of how conservation easements and working lands and the protection of those lands is impacting particular the ecosystems on a you know, farm scale, but also a little bit more regionally. And then finally, one of the things that I could do an entire, I think, lecture on is the opportunities for water sharing in the future, particularly with these conserved lands. I hit upon in-stream flows earlier. We're working with the Colorado Water Trust and some municipalities to think through how that water can be left in streams during specific times and specific reaches. And again, this is sharing some of the water. This isn't pulling all of the water off a farm. This is thinking through ways that we can incentivize farmers and landowners to leave some of that water in the river, at least for particular stretches, and then potentially get picked up downstream by someone else, like a municipality that could use it or another farmer. And there could be payment for that. And then also this alleviates some of the pressure from conventional buy and dry practices, particularly in the Northern Front Range, but in also other places like down on the Arkansas River, where we've seen, you know, entire counties like Crowley County be dried up. And there's some pretty devastating economic impacts associated with that. And so trying to put all the pieces together to think about how we can share that water once we protect that land. And that's, in a nutshell, kind of what we're doing at Colorado Open Lands in terms of thinking through land conservation on working lands and how they can support larger ecosystems in public lands in particular. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So Jen Sitterson has a question. Have you come across a previous easement that's not worked, or due to changing climate has shifted ecosystems? And if so, how was that handled? And are there any legal implications with respect to that? And then, you know, how are you looking at climate change when you're looking at these easements?
Yeah, great question. We're trying to think in terms of making these landscapes resilient. Right now, with how fast Colorado is growing, our primary focus is just protecting what we can. We know we need widespread open land, and we also need the water that supports that land. And so my conversations are let's get it protected, and then we can start thinking about how we build in resiliency into those landscapes. I know that's not a very specific answer for you there, but.
So right, I have a question. Excuse me, Karen. I have a question about how do you approach these ranchers or ranches? I mean, does word of mouth tell them that they want to contact you, or, you know, what's your marketing plan essentially?
Yeah, the best marketing plan is across a fence post, really. You know, if they hear it from a neighbor, someone that they trust, especially someone coming from, you know, a city. You know, I live in Fort Collins. I'm not on a ranch. And so it's definitely peer-to-peer, I would say, is the best way for us to do our outreach. And we've got some farmers and landowners that do that for us and recognize the value. And they can also speak to the story of what their experience was like with us and what it's like, you know, after they've had an easement for 5 to 10 years, and what our relationship was like. And so that's our best outreach. In terms of that, if I could just get back to that last question Jan had, in terms of, you know, ecosystems changing, we've run into a few situations where, you know, in terms of the ag lens, a farm is around it has just grown up into a subdivision. For instance, we have a 7-acre conservation easement in Wheat Ridge. Does it make sense for them to continue to irrigate that farm and grow corn there? Probably not. And so we're starting to see, you know, now that we're 40 years into conservation easements, land use changes that are affecting that particular use of that property. And so I think that's going to be a continuing, evolving discussion in terms of how we adjust conservation easements. There's certain things that we can adjust, but there are some other things that we can work with landowners to try to address. And in many cases, it's coming up with more water. You know, 3 acre per acre might not be enough to grow certain crops in 25 years. And so thinking about optimization, maybe it's water conservation, maybe it's only farming, you know, 10 acres instead of 40, and restoring that 40 acres or 30 acres to shortgrass prairie or something like that. And so I think that we do have some flexibility built into the easements, and there are going to be some things that we didn't anticipate as we put these together. And that's going to be a hot topic here in the future. No pun intended.
Well, and that's a wonderful way for me to introduce our speaker next week, who will be Ann Castle, and she will be talking about land use planning and coordination with water activities. So that was perfect, Carmen. Any other questions for Carmen?
I was just curious. You talked about, you know, how someone goes out every year and checks on the land and makes sure, you know, the owners are abiding by the conservation easement. What are some of the testing procedures, and what are some things that are done to kind of, I guess, quantify that, and how do they measure that?
Yeah, good question. So when we do a conservation easement, one of the requirements is to put together what's called a baseline report or present conditions report. And that's essentially a snapshot of the property that's put together by a biologist. It's maps, it's photo points, it's a documentation of the history of how that property's been used, and it gives us kind of a both quantitative and qualitative snapshot of what that property looks like. And so we can go back and compare it to that each year. And so we take photo points from those same photo points. We do interviews with the landowners about the land use and any structures, anything like that. And then we compared to aerials, sometimes we'll fly over properties. We have an 86,000 acre easement in the San Luis Valley that even has a 14er on it. And so that's a tough one to monitor. And so sometimes we incorporate air flights to do some of that. But basically we compare it to the extensive data that's put together at the time of the conservation easement. It's not perfect, but that's kind of the industry standard at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I had a quick question.
Go ahead, CJ.
You mentioned that these agreements go forward in perpetuity. So that would be even if the land changes hands and ownership down the road, the conservation easement remains. Isn't that right?
Correct.
So where is your power to enforce and maintain these agreements derived from if you're not a government entity? You said you are a nonprofit organization. Like, where is your power to do that derived from?
It's a statutorily created enforcement right, but it's also based in contract law. It's very similar in some cases to a deed restriction. So if you were to record a deed restriction that said that, you know, this property can never be subdivided, that's a contractual enforcement provision. So it's a combination of the two with regard to conservation easements, but both federal statute and Colorado statute provides for that enforcement right for a qualified land trust, in which we are in this case.
Thank you.
Now, I will say just one quick note on that. Easements are perpetual in nature, but they're still subject to eminent domain and condemnation actions. So again, if, you know, a road's being expanded or a reservoir is being put in, then there's the potential that the conservation easement would essentially, be taken, much like a taking of land for public need.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Are there any direct financial cost landowners who are interested in entering into conservation easements?
Yeah, great question. There are. They're not cheap. Generally speaking, an easement will cost, you know, between $70,000 and $80,000 in terms of the appraisal. We have to have a specialized appraisal done that's reviewed very critically for good reason. We've had abuses in the past of people overinflating conservation easement values for tax benefits. And then there's legal. We actually require a stewardship reserve contribution. So we have an endowment in place that's, I think, roughly $8 million now. That essentially is our insurance to say that we're going to be around in perpetuity to monitor these easements. So anytime we take a new easement, we generally require an endowment contribution, and that can be $25,000 per easement. And so it gets pretty expensive. So you have to make sure when you're talking to a landowner, you know, it's worth going through that at expense in terms of the proceeds you're going to get at the end of the day. That being said, there's also a lot of transaction cost funding assistance out there in terms of grants and other organizations that will fund those transaction costs. And so we try to minimize that for our landowners, particularly, you know, when we're talking to, you know, a working farm or ranch where they just don't have that cash sitting around. I came from a land trust back east originally, and we worked on a lot of, I guess, what you would call second homes or estates, gentleman type farms. And so those weren't really working farms. And so that money wasn't as big of a deal to a lot of our folks that are, you know, this is their living out here. And so it's a big expense.
I'm not sure if you covered this, but in terms of the potential glade reservoir being built, how does that affect any of the land conservation easements up there?
It doesn't impact any of our easements. So that area where the reservoir is sited is not conserved with the conservation easement.
Thank you.
However, their plan, they have a lot of mitigation to do and is set out in the documents that they've been working with the feds. And so Carmen has worked with Northern Water on some other conservation type easements. So it's one of the tools in the toolbox, I think, as we move forward, as that project moves forward.
Yeah. So a lot of times you'll hear about mitigation banks or conservation banks that offset impacts, you know, like CDOT, if they're expanding a highway or a reservoir is going in. In many cases, to mitigate those impacts to potential habitat or wetlands, those organizations have to offset or mitigate via conservation easements and or some sort of restoration component. And so there will likely be some banks or mitigation conservation easements as a result of that project.
Interesting.
Any other questions? Well, Carmen, that was just wonderful. Thank you so much. The legal and the policy and the examples, I think, were great. And you're getting a lot of hand claps, I see, from the class. So really appreciate you taking some time from your vacation and your family gathering to join us. And we look forward to having you join the class on other issues.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And we'll post a link to the slideshow. And if you have any questions, my email's on there. Happy to chat with anyone at any point. So thanks again. All right.